Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Kim Aubrey. Each week, we visit with an author from our region. We get an introduction to their work, sometimes a glimpse into their lives, find out what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. We're very pleased to have Kim with us today. Kim Aubrey is a Canadian writer who was born and grew up in Bermuda and has lived in Toronto, Saskatoon, and now Coburg. Kim's short story collection, What We Hold in Our Hands, was published by Demeter Press a year ago. Her stories, poems, and essays have appeared in Best Canadian Stories, The New Quarterly, Numero 5, Event, Room Magazine, and the Globe and Mail, How to Expect What You're Not Expecting, and other journals and anthologies. Kim is a founding member and editor of Red Claw Press, a small press based in Toronto, and she recently worked as fiction and non-fiction editor for Grain magazine in Saskatoon. In 2003, she earned an MFA in writing fiction from Vermont College. And in 2009, in an attempt to reconnect with her island home, Kim started Writer's Workshop in Bermuda, an annual week-long retreat for writers seeking inspiration and community in a beautiful island setting. So, Kim, welcome.
Hi, Felicity.
You spent 2 years working for your low residency MFA at Vermont College, which you completed in 2003. Can you tell us about that experience and how it helped you establish yourself as a writer?
The MFA program helped me to be a better writer. The two main things I think it gave me were craft and community. When I started, I didn't know how much I still had to learn as a writer. I'd taken several writing classes and I'd belonged to a writer's group for many years. But I learned more in the 2 years doing the MFA than I had in the previous 10 years writing on my own. And the other thing I was looking for when I applied was community, a wider literary community. And it really did give me that. I was actually surprised, you know, that you do sometimes get what you ask for. So, and I think with a wider community, you're exposed to more ideas and you're also exposed to more opportunities. Mm-hmm. And that helped me to establish myself as a writer.
Mm. Many of the stories you published in your collection, What We Hold in Our Hands, you wrote while studying in Vermont, but others more recently. Could you tell us about the collection? Do you especially like the short story form, and what do you think makes for a good collection?
Yeah, the collection was my creative thesis when I did the MFA. Only two of the stories have been added since then. The stories are about family and motherhood and about art and artists. And one of my favorite stories in the collection was written in response to the Yes, Yoko Ono exhibit at the AGO in 2002, I think it was. I went to the exhibit once and I was inspired to write the story. And then I went back twice for research. But my character in the story goes to the exhibit 9 times because she's trying to learn something from it. That was an interesting way of writing in response to art.
Yeah. So perhaps you'll read from that one in a minute when we give you a chance.
And as for the short story form, I like the tighter structure. You can't get lost in the short story in the way you can in a novel. It's not as luxurious. You don't have that luxury of time and space, but it can be more intense, I think. There's shorter blasts, and it can be punchier. Think of someone like Alice Munro, who she packs as a novel into each short story, into 20 or 30 pages. So it is, yes. It is in some ways my favorite form.
And so having a theme like that, mothers and artists, mm-hmm. was a way of pulling a collection together.
Yes, and I think there are other ways of pulling a collection together, too. It can be something like style, or it can be place. If I mm-hmm. think about Alice Munro's Huron County or Mavis sure. Gallant's post-war Europe.
Right.
I think, to me, that's what makes a cohesive collection, something where you feel like the characters in all the stories might know each other, that they mm-hmm. inhabit the same world.
Yes. So sometimes you also write memoir, And a piece called Fall and Spring was published in 2013 in an anthology, How to Expect What You're Not Expecting. What's this essay about, and why did you write that?
It took me 15 years to write that essay. Yes. And I realized I started writing it when my oldest daughter started university. And the essay really was about my first attempt at going away to university and finding out that I was pregnant. And the first thing I did when I got on campus was to go for a pregnancy test.
Oh, goodness.
And so that decision to have the baby and get married really defined my life. So I think I wrote the essay trying to figure out, you know, trying to understand that decision and, you know, why I had made it. And my daughter starting university probably got me going on that. Uh-huh. But I found myself working on that essay again when I started the MFA program. Even though I was in the fiction program, I started writing this nonfiction piece. And then I was told very politely that I would have to get back to writing fiction, which I did. I was really happy to do. But after I finished the MFA, I started work on a memoir, and some of the memoir found its way into that essay as well. So it did, in fact, take me 15 years to write. Yeah.
Must have been quite an experience to write that, and maybe you'll have time to read a bit of that one with two. Anyway, right now, we would like you to choose a piece to read. So what will you choose?
Well, I was going to read from the first story, which is loosely based on my own life. It's a young mother and her baby, although I made her a little bit older than I was. Anyway, I'll read. The story is called Over Our Heads. One day when Alice and I were out walking our familiar route along Bloor Street, she reached towards an empty paper cup on the sidewalk ahead, leaned forward in her stroller and flexed her fingers wide as if she could see, taste, smell, and hear with them. Then in one fluid movement, she dove out and struck the pavement. I scooped her up. Her nose was bleeding, and she was bawling. I started to wail with her, devastated at my failure to protect her. I'd buckled the strap that held her in, but must not have pulled it tight enough. Pushing the empty stroller, I carried Alice to her doctor's office in the next block. Even living in the big city, our world was small. Everything within walking distance, just like back home. The doctor cleaned her face and said she was fine. The next day, a violet bruise spread across the bridge of her nose, fading to a green smudge by the end of the week. When we went walking, people looked from Alice's nose to my face and tagged me as an irresponsible or maybe even abusive teenage mother, like the ones you hear about on the news, who leave their toddlers alone overnight while they go dancing, or let them play next to 12-story high open windows, or shake them until their brains are scrambled and they stop crying. Whenever I heard those stories, I imagined a superhero swooping in to rescue not only the babies but the mothers too, by carrying them away from the scene of neglect and desperation, by setting them down on solid ground. She would somehow transform and restore them, leaving them better able to cope. Cam and I were coping, keeping Alice safe and healthy. I cooked her chicken livers and brown rice. Cam stuck safety plugs into the electric outlets and made sure the windows and balcony door were always locked. I took Alice to every checkup and monitored the temperature of her bathwater, never letting my eyes stray from her while she was in the tub. But often I cried from sheer exhaustion and longed to be transported to Paris or Vienna, where I imagined myself eating brioche and jam in an outdoor cafe while discussing books and art with dark-eyed, bearded men. That November, as my birthday approached and these daydreams became more frequent, I discovered an Austrian cafe on Bloor Street where I could sit for half an hour with a cup of sweet coffee before Alice grew bored with her toys and the bites of pastry I offered as bribes. I watched her taste chocolate and almond paste for the first time, puzzlement, delight, or disgust blooming in her blue eyes. When she grew restless, I'd take her for long walks, window shopping and browsing for books through the cool, dull, darkening afternoons. It was on one of these walks that I saw a guy I'd known at home, a boyfriend of my older sister, Ellie. Alice had fallen asleep in her stroller, and I'd wheeled her into the bookstore out of the cold when I saw him. Jackson used to hang around our house or drive us into town, where we'd watch a movie, my brothers and I sitting near the front, while Jackson and Ellie sat in the back making out. You'd have thought Ellie would have been the one to get pregnant and marry young, not me. Back then, she never seemed to have a thought in her head that didn't involve boys or clothes. But now she was at teacher's college, sharing a house with a group of women who didn't shave their legs or wear deodorant. And here I was, a mother and wife, spritzing my wrists with free perfume every time I walked through the first floor of the bay. Jackson looked different from how I remembered him, sitting expressionless on our family's living room couch, watching TV with Ellie wedged up against his side. Now he was reading a Penguin paperback, his face unshaven, brown hair long and wavy, tucked behind one ear so that he could see the page. He looked like any other university student in his heavy knit sweater, army pants, and running shoes, except more real and somehow larger than life, because he was from back home, and I hadn't expected to see him here. Parking the stroller across the aisle, I picked up a book from the discount table, peering at him as I flipped through Joyce's Dubliners. Then reading, I forgot about Jackson until I felt a hand on my back and looked up into his bloodshot eyes. "Janelle, I thought it was you. I saw you reading, but I didn't want to disturb you," I said. I could smell the lemony perfume I'd sprayed on at the bay and the mixture of cigarette smoke, marijuana, and perspiration escaping from his sweater. A pattern of X's crossed his chest, over a pair of canoe paddles also crossed. I shook my head a little to make my dark hair ripple. "I wrote a paper on Joyce's stories," he said, ducking his head and scratching his chin the way he used to when he was unsure of himself or talking to one of Ellie's lip-glossed girlfriends. "I thought you were in Montreal," I said. "Not anymore. I'm doing my master's here." I felt young and stupid, afraid to say the wrong thing. "How's your sister?" he asked. "She's at Western in Teachers College." "Those days seem long ago, don't they, kid?" He always used to call me kid and ruffle my hair. His hand rose, then stopped.
Thank you, Kim. Now we'll take a short break.